Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, good evening. This is the LA School Show. I'm sorry I was involved here. I'm having some technical difficulties with this miserable thing. What I'm trying to do is open up the chat room, but I can't because I've got a problem with my flash, and I'm on Internet Explorer because my Mozilla Foxfire doesn't work, can't get me on, and I'm having terrible problems with this stuff today. So bear with me. I'm sorry I can't set up my chat room because of this archaic system of Internet Explorer. It's a horrible mess. So anyway, I apologize. But tonight I wanted to finish the essay on eloquence by Ralph Waldo Emerson, and I'm hoping I have enough time with this after this essay, because we started it last week, and I'm hoping that we have enough time tonight to play an interview with Richard Grossman, who wrote a fascinating book. The Tao of Emerson. Richard is a friend of mine. I've known for some time. He's a psychotherapist as well, and lives in the local area here. But he's an Emersonian scholar, and that's how we got to know each other, through one of his lectures. And I was fascinated with this particular work, and I'm going to mention some of it later. But let me continue with eloquence, which is one of Emerson's lesser known essays, but it's very astute. And we'll begin where we left off last week. And I've got a few more pages left to this essay, and hopefully I can get it done in half an hour. This balance between the orator and the audience is expressed in what is called the pertinence of the speaker. There is always a rivalry between the orator and the occasion, between the demands of the hour and the preposition of the prepossession of the individual. The emergency which has convened the meeting is usually of more importance than anything the debaters have in their minds, and therefore become imperative to them. The reason I'm reading this, and the reason I thought this would be a good essay, is because we're always striving to communicate. I am, and many times I miss the mark. And even when I'm reading from other people who miss the mark as well sometimes. But hopefully you'll bear with me, and I'd like to complete this because it is rather an interesting essay. The emergency which has convened the meeting is usually of more importance than anything the debaters have in their minds, and therefore becomes imperative to them. But if one of them has anything of commanding necessity in his heart, how speedily he will find vent for it and the applause of the assembly. This balance is observed in the privatest intercourse. Poor Tom never knew the time when the present occurrence was so trivial that he could not tell what was passing in his mind without being checked for unseasonable speech. But let Bacon speak, and wise men would rather listen, though the revolution of kingdoms was on foot. I have heard it reported of an eloquent preacher, whose voice is not yet forgotten in this city, that on occasion of death or tragic disaster, which overspread the congregation with gloom, he ascended the pulpit, and more than his usual Turning to his favorite lesson of devout and jubilant thankfulness, let us praise the Lord, carried audience mourners, and mourning along with him, and swept away all the impertinence of private sorrows and his hosannas and songs of praise. Pepys says of Lord Clarendon, with whom he is mad in love, on his return from a conference, I did never observe how much easier a man does speak when he knows all the company to be below him than in him. For though he spoke indeed excellent well, yet his manner and freedom of doing it, as if he played with it and was informing only all the rest of the company, was mighty pretty. This is, again, these essays were written 150 years ago, so of course the English is a little different, but he's quoting this individual. But I have to say that as a public speaker and a teacher, and I've been giving many lectures, I know this possibly is more personal to me, this essay, than others, because I know how difficult it is to reach the mark. And when you do, and when you do have any, when your audience does respond to you in a favorable way, you know that you've reached a nerve, and you've done what you set out to do, and you've achieved some level of eloquence. This rivalry between the orator and the occasion is inevitable, and the occasion always yields to the eminence of the speaker, for a great man is the greatest of occasions. Of course, the interest of the audience and of the orator conspire. It is well with them only when his influence is complete, then only they are well pleased. And especially he consults his power by making instead of taking his theme. If he should attempt to instruct the people in that which they already know, he would fail. But by making them wise in that which he knows, he has the advantage of the assembly every moment. Napoleon's tactics of marching on the angle of an army and always presenting a superiority of numbers is the orator's secret also. The several talents which the orator employs, the splendid weapons which went to the equipment of Ashenes and Demosthenes, the natural orator of Fox, of Pitt, or of Patrick Henry, of Adams, of Marlborough, deserve a special enumeration. We must not quite omit to name the principal pieces. The orator, as we have seen, must be a substantial personality. Then first he must have power of statement, must have the fact and know how to tell it. In any knot of men conversing on any subject, the person who knows most about it will have the ear of the company, if he wishes it, and leads the conversation. No matter what genius or distinction other men there present may have, and in any public assembly, him who has the facts and can and will state them, people will listen to, though he is otherwise ignorant, though he is hoarse and ungraceful, though he stutters and screams. People are hungry for fact, they're hungry for knowledge, and they know it when they hear it, most of the time, whether they like it or not. In a course of justice, the audiences are impartial. They really wish to sift the statements and know what the truth is. And in the examination of witnesses, there usually leap out quite unexpectedly three or four stubborn words or phrases which are the pith and fate of the business, which sink into the ear of all parties and stick there and determine the cause. All the rest is repetition and qualifying, and the court and the county have really come together to arrive at these three or four memorable expressions which betray the mind and meaning of somebody. In every company, the man with the fact is like the guide you hire to lead your party up a mountain or through a difficult country. He may not compare with any of the party in mind or breeding or courage or possessions, but he is much more important to the present need than any of them. That is what we go to the courthouse for, the statement of the fact and the elimination of a general fact, the real relation of all the parties, and it is the certainty with which, indifferently, in any affair that is well handled, the truth stares us in the face through all the disguises that are put upon it. A piece of the well-known human life that makes the interest of a courtroom to the intelligent spectator. I remember long ago being attracted by the distinction of the counsel and the local importance of the cause into the courtroom. The prisoner's counsel were the strongest and cunningest lawyers in the Commonwealth. They drove the attorney for the state from corner to corner, taking his reasons from under him and reducing him to silence, but not to submission. When hard-pressed, he revenged himself in his turn on the judge by requiring the court to define what savage was. The court thus pushed tried words and even everything it could think of to fill the time, supposing cases and describing duties of insurers and captains and pilots and miscellaneous sea officers that are or might be, like a schoolmaster puzzled by a hard sum who reads the context with emphasis. But all this flood not serving the cuttlefish to get away in, the horrible shark of the district attorney being still there, grimly awaiting with his, the court must define, the poor court pleading its inferiority. The superior court must establish the law for this and read away piteously the decisions of the Supreme Court, but read to those who had no pity. And the judge is forced at last to rule something, and the lawyers saved their robe under the fog of definition. The parts were so well cast and discriminate that it was an interesting game to watch, and the government was well enough represented. It was stupid, but it had a strong will and possession, and stood on that to the last. Don't we see that all the time, the stupidity of the government's position, but the strength of that position? And they'll stand by it and convict innocent men. The judge has a task beyond his preparation, yet his position remained real. He was there to represent a great reality, the justice of states, which he could well enough see beetling over his head, and which his trifling talk nowise affected and did not impede, since he was entirely well-meaning. And the statement of the fact, however, sinks before the statement of the law, which requires immeasurably high powers and is a rarest gift, being in all great masters one and the same thing. In lawyers, nothing technical, but always some piece of common sense alike interesting to laymen as to clerks. Lord Mansfield's merit is the merit of common sense. It is the same quality we admire in Aristotle or Montaigne or Cervantes or in Samuel Johnson or in Franklin. Its application to law seems quite accidental. Each of Mansfield's famous decisions contains a level sentence or two which hit the mark. His sentences are not always finished to the eye, but are finished to the mind, and the sentences are involved, but a solid proposition is set forth, a true distinction is drawn, and they come from and go to the sound human undertaking. And I read without surprise that the black-letter lawyers of the day sneered at his equitable decisions, as if they were not also learned. This indeed is what speech is for, to make the statement, and all this is called eloquence. Seems to me of little use, for the most part, to those who have it, but inestimable to such as have something to say. And next to the knowledge of the fact and its law is method, which constitutes the genius and efficiency of the remarkable men, of all remarkable men. And a crowd of men go up to Faneuil Hall. They are all pretty well acquainted with the objects of the meeting. They have all read the facts in the same newspapers. The orators possess no information which his hearings have not. yet he teaches them to see the things with his eyes. By the new placing, the circumstance acquire new solidity and worth. Every fact gains a consequence by his naming it, and trifles become important. His expressions fix themselves in memory and fly from mouth to mouth. His mind has some new principle of order. Where he looks, all things fly into their places. What will he say next? Let his man speak, and this man only. By applying the habits of a higher style of thought to the common affairs of this world, he introduces beauty and magnificence wherever he goes. And such a power was Burke's, and of this genius we have had some brilliant examples in our own political and legal men. Imagery. The orator must be, to a certain extent, a poet. We are still imaginative creatures, that nothing so works on the human mind, barbarous or civil, as a trope. Condense some daily experience into a glowing symbol, and an audience is electrified. They feel as if they already possess some new right and power over a fact which they can detach, and so completely master in thought. It is a wonderful aid to the memory, which carries away the image and never loses it. A popular assembly like the House of Commons or the French Chamber or the American Congress is commanded by these two powers, first by a fact, then by skill of statement. Put the argument into a concrete shape, into an image, some hard phrase, round and solid as a ball, which they can see and handle and carry home with them, and the cause is half won. Statement, method, imagery, selection, tenacity, and memory, power of dealing with the facts, of illuminating them, of sinking them by ridicule or by diversion of the mind, rapid generalization, humor, pathos, are keys which the orator holds. And yet these fine gifts are not eloquence and do not often hinder a man's attainment of it. And if we come to the heart of the mystery, perhaps we should say that the truly eloquent man is a sane man with power to communicate his sanity. I don't want to repeat that line because I like it so much. And if we come to the heart of the mystery, perhaps we should say that the truly eloquent man is a sane man with power to communicate his sanity. If you arm the man with the extraordinary weapons of his art, give him a grasp of facts, learning, quick fancy, sarcasm, splendid illusion, and interminable illustration, all these talents, so potent and charming, have an equal power to ensnare and mislead the audience and the orator. His talents are too much for him. His horses run away with him, and people always perceive whether you drive or whether the horses take the bits in their teeth and run. But these talents are quite something else when they are subordinated and serve him. And we go to Washington or to Westminster Hall, or might well go round the world to see a man who drives and is not run away with, a man who in prosecuting great designs has an absolute command of the means of representing his ideas and uses them only to express these, placing facts, placing men, amid the inconceivable levity of human beings, never for an instant warped from his erectness. There is for every man a statement possible of that truth which he is most unwilling to receive, a statement possible so broad and so pungent that he cannot get away from it, but must either bend to it or die of it. Else there would be no such word as eloquence, which means this: the listener cannot hide from himself that something has been shown him and the whole world which he did not wish to see, and as he cannot dispose of it, it disposes of him. And the history of public men and affairs in America will readily furnish tragic examples of this fatal force. For the triumphs of the art, somewhat more must still be required, namely a reinforcing of man from events so as to give the double force of reason and destiny. In transcendent eloquence, there was ever some crisis in affairs, such as could deeply engage the man to the cause he pleads and draw all his wide power to the point. For the explosions and eruptions, there must be accumulations of heat somewhere, beds of ignited anthracite at the center, and in cases where profound conviction has been wrought, the eloquent man is he who is no beautiful speaker, but who is inwardly drunk with a certain belief. It activates and tears him, and perhaps almost bereaves him of power of articulation. Then it rushes from him as, in short, abrupt screams and torrents of meaning, and the possession the subject has of his mind is so entire that it ensures an order of expression which is the order of nature itself, and so the order of the greatest force and inimitable by any art. And the main distinction between him and other well-graced actors is the conviction communicated by every word that his mind is contemplating a whole and inflamed by the contemplation of the whole, and that the words and sentences uttered by him, however admirable, fall from him as unregarded parts of that terrible whole which he sees and which he means that you shall see. Add to this concentration a certain regnant calmness, which in all the tumult never utters a premature syllable, but keeps the secret of its means and methods, and the orator stands before the people as a demoniacal power to whose miracles they have no key. This terrible earnestness makes good the ancient superstition of the hunter, that the bullet will hit its mark, which is first dipped in the markman's blood. Eloquence must be grounded on the plainest narrative. Afterwards, it may harm itself until it exhales symbols of every kind and color, speaks only through the most poetic forms, but first and last, it must still be at the bottom a biblical statement of fact. The orator is thereby an orator that he keeps his feet ever on fact. Thus only is he invincible. No gifts, no graces, no power of wit or learning or illustration will make any amends for his want of this. All audiences are just to this point. Fame of voice or of rhetoric will carry people a few times to hear a speaker, but they soon begin to ask, what is he driving at? And if this man does not stand for anything, he will be deserted. A good upholder of anything which they believe, a fact speaker of any kind, they will long follow. But a pause in the speaker's own character is very properly a loss of attraction. And the preacher enumerates his classes of men, and I do not find many my place therein. I suspect then that no man does, and everything is my cousin, and whilst he speak things, I feel that he is touching some of my relations, and I am uneasy. But whilst he deals in words, we are released from intention. If you would lift me, you must be on higher ground. If you would liberate me, you must be free. If you would correct my faults, you, of facts, hold up to me the same facts in the true order of thought, and I cannot go back from a new conviction. The power of Chatham, of Pericles, of Luther, rested on the strength of character, which because it did not and could not fear anybody, made nothing of their antagonists, and became sometimes exquisitely provoking, and sometimes terrific to these. We are slenderly furnished with the anecdotes of these men who can we help ourselves by those heavy books in which their discourses are reported. Some of them were writers like Burke, but most of them were not, and no record at all adequate to their fame remains. Besides, what is best is lost, the fiery life of the moment. But the conditions for eloquence always exist. It is always dying out of famous places and appearing and corners. Wherever the polarities meet, wherever the flesh, or wherever the fresh moral sentiment, the instinct of freedom and duty come in direct opposition to fossil conservatism and the thirst of gain, the spark will pass. The resistance to slavery in this country has been a fruitful nursery of orators. The natural connection by which it drew to itself a train of moral reforms and the slight yet sufficient party organizations it offered reinforced the city with new blood from the woods and the mountains. Wild men, John Baptists, hermits, Peters, John Knoxes, utter the savage sentiment of nature in the hearts of commercial capitals. They send there every year some piece of aboriginal strength, some thought oak stick of a man who is not to be silenced or insulted or intimidated by a mob because he is more mob than they. One who mobs the mob, some sturdy countryman on whom neither money nor politeness nor hard words nor eggs nor blows nor brickbats make any impression. He is fit to meet the barroom's wits and bullies. He is a wit and a bully himself and something more. He is a graduate of the plow and the stub hoe and the bushwhacker and knows all the secrets of swamp and snowbank and is nothing to learn of labor or poverty or the rough of farming. His hard head went through the childhood, the drill of Calvinism, with text and mortification, so that he stands in the New England Assembly a purer bit of New England than any, and flings his sarcasms right and left. He has not only the documents in his hands or in his pockets to answer all cavils and to prove all his positions, but he has the eternal reason in his head. This man scornfully renounces your civil organizations, county or city or governor or army, is his own navy and artillery, judge and jury, legislator and executive. He has learned his lessons in a bitter school. Yet if the pupil be of a texture to bear it, the best university that can be recommended to a man of ideas is the gauntlet of the mobs. He who will train himself to master in the science of persuasion must lay the emphasis of education not on popular arts but on character and insight. Let him see that his speech is not differenced from action, that when he has spoken, he has not done nothing, nor done wrong, but has cleared his own skirts, has engaged himself to the wholesome exertion. Let him look on opposition as opportunity. He cannot be defeated by or put down. There is a principle of resurrection in him, any immortality of purpose. Men are adverse and hostile to give value to their suffrages. It is not the people that are in fault for not being convinced, but he that cannot convince them. He should mold them, armed as he is with reason and love, which are also the core of their nature. He is not to neutralize their opposition, but he is to convert them into fiery apostles and publishers of the same wisdom. The highest platform of eloquence is the moral sentiment. It is what is called affirmative truth and has the property of invigorating the hearer, and it conveys a hint of our eternity when he feels himself addressed on grounds which will remain when everything else is taken and which has no trace of time or place or party. Everything hostile is stricken down in the presence of the sentiments. Their majesty is felt by the most obdurate. It is observable that as soon as one acts for large masses, the moral element will and must be allowed for, will and must work, and the men least accustomed to appeal to these sentiments invariably recall them when they address nations. Napoleon even must accept and use it as he can. It is only to these simple strokes that the highest power belongs when a weak human hand touches point by point the eternal beams and rafters on which the whole structure of nature and society is laid. In this tossing sea of delusion, we feel with our feet the adamant. In this domination of chance, we find a principle of permanence. For I do not accept that definitions of Isocrates, that the office of his art is to make the great small and the small great. But I esteem this to be its perfection, when the orator sees through all masks to the eternal scale of truth in such short that he can hold up before the eyes of men the fact of today steadily to that standard, thereby making the great great and the small small, which is the true way to astonish and to reform mankind. All the great first orators of the world have been grave men relying on this reality. One thought the philosophers of Demosthenes' his own time found running through all his orations, this namely, that virtue secures its own success. And to stand on one's own feet, a heron finds the keynote to the discourses of Demosthenes as of Chatham. And these are, of course, orators. And eloquence, like every other art, rests on laws the most exact and determinate. It is the best speech of the best soul. It may well stand as the exponent of all that is grand and immortal in the mind. If it does not so become an instrument, but aspires to be somewhat of itself and to glitter for show, it is false and weak. And in its right exercise, it is an elastic, unexhausted power, who has sounded, who has estimated it. Expanding with the expansions of our interests and affections. Its great masters, whilst they valued every help to its attainment, and thought no pains too great which contributed to any manner of to further it, and resembling the Arabian warriors of fame who wore 16 weapons in his belt, and in personal combat used them all occasionally, yet undervalued all means, never permitted any talent, neither voice, rhythm, poetic power, anecdote, sarcasm, to appear for show, but were grave men who preferred their integrity to their talent, and esteemed that object for which they toiled, whether the prosperity of their country, or the laws, or a reformation, or a liberty of speech, or of the press, or letters, or morals, as above the whole world, and themselves also. So, essentially, I end that based on what he's saying. Anyone can be eloquent if they believe in what they're saying. Now I'm going to go to an interview with Richard Grossman, and I hope I have this queued up properly. If you can give me just a second while I find my earphones here. And let's see if we have it.
I've read most of a lot of his essays.
I'm just going to rewind this a little bit, and we're going to go to this interview with Richard Grossman. And this was done Tuesday night, so you'll hear Lila as well, asking some questions and reading.
Translated into English till 9 years after he died.
It's a little longer than I thought here. Hang on one second. Sorry, I have to cue this up here. I lost my trials of radio show host. But I wanted to state that the book is called The Tao of Emerson, and it was written by Richard Grossman. actor written, it was edited. And what he did is he compared Lao Tse's words and wisdom to that of Ralph Emerson. And the thing was is that Ralph Emerson actually never knew or had never read of the Tao. The Tao hadn't been translated till 1895, I believe, and it's about 6 years before, or 6 years after Ralph Waldo Emerson passed away. So he was not familiar with the Tao, but the Tao absolutely flows through his work, which is proven by Richard Grossman in this, this book. Hang on a second here. Give a little background on him. Okay. Okay, we're going to be doing it. Right.
First of all, I'd like to say that Richard Grossman is offering two lectures and workshops Saturday, May 9th and May 16th at 2 p.m. at the Scoville Memorial Library in Salisbury. The title of his workshop is How Can I Help? Compassion and Detachment in Everyday Life. In addition to his 20 years as a medical educator, Richard Grossman has been in private practice of psychotherapy and health counseling for almost four decades. For 17 of those years, he has also spent from 2 to 5 weeks each year working with groups of severely ill persons in retreats organized by the Wainwright House in Rye, New York, and Smith Farm for Healing and Arts in Washington, D.C. At one time, he was vice president of book publisher Simon & Schuster and the Viking Press, and founder of his own publishing house, Grossman Publishers. He is an author himself, having written 6 books, including Choosing and Changing, The Other Medicines, the award-winning A Year with Emerson, and most recently, the book that we're going to talk to him about this evening, The Tao of Emerson. And I think Richard is with us. Welcome to the L.A. Steel Show, Richard.
You're welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, I'm fine. How are you this evening?
Very good, thank you.
I would just like to start off to mention, just because I don't want to forget, and I did mention it, that you're having a lecture and workshop at the Scoville Memorial Library, How Can I Help? Compassion and Detachment in Everyday Life. Is that a lecture that people have to sign up for, or what is...
No, they just have to show up.
They just have to show up.
No charge. It's a lecture workshop combination.
Okay. At 2 p.m. at the Scoville Memorial.
2 p.m. on the 9th and on the 16th.
Good. I think that's a great topic, and I bet you'll get a big turnout for that.
I hope so.
Oh, I think you will. And Leo and I just read passage 41, selections 41 from your book. I read the Tao, and he read Emerson, and it's amazing how you've set that up with the similarities. And I was wondering, maybe you could answer for us.
Yeah.
Since there's no direct...
It's really an unusual exercise in comparative philosophy, isn't it?
It really is. And there's no direct link between Emerson and Tao Te Ching. How do you account for their similarities, Richard?
Well, I think it's a matter of spirit, clearly, because there was no possible connection. Emerson could not have ever read a word of the Tao because it wasn't translated into English until 9 years after he died. He was very familiar with Confucius.
Right.
Who had been translated much earlier, and he loved Confucius. But on the other hand, he would have loved Lao Tzu even better, because Confucius was interested in things like reputation and getting ahead, that kind of thing, and that's not what Emerson was concerned with.
Yeah. Okay, do you have another question?
Well, I was going to say, how did you go about choosing your selections? I mean, they were very good selections, I thought.
Well, it really was kind of a quirky project, wasn't it? I mean, it could only have been done by someone who was very much involved with both works, and I have been for many, many years, over 50. And what I did was I would just sit and think about, I would read the Tao Te Ching and think about Emerson, and conversely, I'd read Emerson and think about the Tao Te Ching, and my memory would jog me of in a way to help me point toward the verses I might find that were actually parallel.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very intuitive kind of project.
Oh, it was. I was impressed that it was published by the Modern Library.
Yeah.
They picked that right up. And
yeah, they did. It was very unusual, and I think it's because they didn't have any Emerson on their current list of books as replete as that list has been for so many years, because that's over 75 years old, that Modern Library list.
Oh.
They just happened not to have anything in print by Emerson at the moment, and I think they felt the need, and I'm glad they did.
Yeah, absolutely. And but I guess what I've studied Emerson for many years, but
yeah.
What impressed me were the quotes that you got, and I was trying to some I identified right away, and others were a little more
obscure,
yeah. And I was wondering what some of where you got them, because I've read many of his lectures. I know I haven't read them all. I've read a lot of his essays.
No, I know you have. Yeah.
But there were a few of them that I lost. I mean, a few there that I couldn't quote. I couldn't remember where they came from.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I'm going, where did this one come from?
Uh-huh.
For instance, there was one on 30, on page 30, it says, war begins...
Page 30 or number 30?
Page 30, I think, is it page or 30, or, yeah, page 30, or number 30.
Let me see if I can pick that up here. And here is 30, so you're talking about the 14th chapter.
Oh, yeah.
Where's the 14th verse of the Tao Te Ching?
Is that page 30, or...
Number 30.
Yeah, it's number 30.
Here's
war begins to look like an epidemic, insanity breaking out here and there like the cholera of influenza.
This is actually you're talking about the one about war?
Yeah.
That actually, if I recall correctly, that comes from the essay called War.
Oh, you know, that's why I haven't seen that one. Was that what series was that in?
Not a very well known. Actually, it was not even an essay. It was a lecture.
Ah.
A lecture.
Because I thought, wow.
He called what he called an address.
Okay. Because I didn't know, and it was like, it says war begins to look like an epidemic, insanity, breaking out here and there like the cholera or influenza, infecting men's brains. When seen in the remote past, in the infancy of society, appears a part of the connection of events, and in its place necessary. War and peace thus resolve themselves into a mercury of the state of cultivation. At certain stages, the man fights, if he be of sound body and mind. At a certain higher stage, he makes no offensive demonstration. His warlike nature is all concerted into an active medicinal principle. And I didn't know where that thing came from. And I said, geez, I was looking back through stuff, and I said, wow.
Isn't that amazingly relevant to the last 30 years of this country?
Oh, absolutely.
It sure
absolutely.
Is.
Famous phrase that the Senate of the United States consists of old men who send young men to war, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And it happens over and over again.
Right.
Yeah, and of course the attributing the comparative Tao statement is very very similar. I was amazed because it was a real test of my knowledge, and made me want to go further, and I wanted to call you after I read it and say, geez, where is this stuff? where did you get these? Where did this?
By the way, are you familiar with a website called rwe.org?
No.
Well, that has every word that Emerson ever wrote on one site.
RWE.org.
RWE.org.
Oh, my God.
A great resource for Emersonians, huh?
Incredible resource. And it's readily available, very easy to handle,
okay.
Not complicated at all, very simple site.
Wow.
And a wonderful, wonderful treasure house of things.
Oh, it must be. RWE.org. Okay.
Right.
Well, that would be a good one to look
up. So you can go to that, and they have a table of contents of the complete works.
Wow.
And you'll find the address called War, and you just click on that, and you'll get the entire thing, and you can download it.
All right.
It's all in the public domain, because it's all of Emerson's work is in the public domain.
All right.
You know, it's amazing.
No copyright still obtained, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
You know, it's amazing how humanity has been given these spiritual people. Each generation seems to have one, or culture, and they hit on the essence of what we need to know and speak in the language of the people of the time.
I'm afraid I'm not picking you up.
I said it's amazing how cultures produce people and spirits who are able to articulate in the language of the people what they need to know. To be better than what they are.
It's amazing and a wonderful thing.
It is a wonderful thing to have the gift of these people, and their words, they've lived so long ago, and their words still can speak to us.
Right, exactly.
It's just amazing to me. And
if you could recommend, all right, people, I know you probably, I think your favorite was Self-Reliance, but if you could recommend anybody to read one Emerson essay, all right, what would that be?
Circles.
Circles. Yes. Yeah.
Why that one?
You think so?
Well, I think that's the one that most effectively combines his spiritual orientation and his man of the world situation in the United States. And I think it's one that makes the spiritual extremely available and without a lot of booga booga, as they say.
No, it's true, and you know, it's funny. I've got a little handbook here on Emerson, and I was reading Circles today.
Yeah, that's right.
And I've underlined this so many places what it says is, I'll just read one quick passage. It says, "A key to every man is his thought. Sturdy and defying though he look, he has a helm which he obeys, which is the idea after which all his facts are classified. He can only be reformed by showing him a new idea which commands his own. And the life of man is a self-evolving circle, which from a ring imperceptibly small rushes on all sides outward to new and larger circles, and that without end." And it goes on a bit, but what always caught me about that specific thing was, and I guess that's what I'm trying to do, we try to do here, is bring new thoughts and new ideas to people, you know, because it's the only way it's going to change them. It's the only way it's going to make them see anything differently.
That's right.
Yeah, and it's got to affect them emotionally somehow before it can change them, you know.
And it's got to belong to them individually. We have to experience these things directly as matters of personal experience. We can't just, it is an outdated notion that we get our learnings from other people's ideas and other people's lectures. We're at a point now where we all have to be self-directed individual learners on our own.
That's true. That's so true. You know, the one thing I was going to ask you about this, because a question came up to me. I kept reading through your book, each quote that you had, and each one with the Tao. I noticed that there's this. I recognized it before in Emerson's work, but I never saw it before in the same way. This self-effacement. Basically, you know, it's instructing these.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Hang on one second. I hope you enjoyed what that was. I'm going to try to salvage this. Oh, my God. I hate it when this happens, folks. It doesn't happen too often now, but when you rewind a tape, sometimes it gets caught in your recorder, and that's exactly what happened here. What I'll do is, what I was getting at with the self-effacement aspect of Emerson, as well as what is stated in the Tao, was that the essence to wisdom, if you will, and the wisdom that's so eloquently stated by Emerson and Lao Tse, who is the writer of the Tao, was that we must, in order to respect, or in order to understand these aspects of wisdom, or gain wisdom, we must be self-effacing before we must have self-abandonment, basically, and that's extremely difficult to do. We must put aside our egos, put aside our thought process, if you will, for that of the soul, because inherently the soul knows more than we do, and which is what they are stating. And this is true. I mean, we can be silent in thought, and what Richard was saying is that we can't depend on others for our learning, because we have to research, we have to look into the facts more, and we can't really depend so much on others for we can gather our facts, and we do, and I definitely go to an extent to try to do that, and help to teach people the rules of engagement here. And that's why I read this article tonight on, that's why eloquence is important to me, because we try and try so hard to, we all do, to communicate with others what we feel is important. And unfortunately, what we feel is important isn't so important to others. And then there's the rub, you know. I don't think I'm going to be able to salvage this tape. Not tonight anyway. In the brief time that we have left, but I did want to say that maybe I can read some of the works here before tonight's over, and try to rewind this tape and see what we can salvage from it. You may have asked by now, why does he still continue with these tapes? And it's only because my show is broadcast at the studio, and they do not have a taped a CD player or a recorder there. They should, but they don't. And unfortunately, the only thing they have that tapes directly to the board is a tape recorder. And I know I've gone through this before with my listeners, and this has happened to me, but I apologize. And I'm going to try to put that together. But there was about another 5 or probably 10 minutes of that interview with Richard. But in the next few minutes, what I'm going to do is try to just read a couple of passages from Richard's book, and it's called, again, The Tao, or The Tao of Emerson, and you can look it up. There is one, you can get it on Amazon.com, or you can, it's put out by the Modern Library, and very, very well done book. It's a hardcover. Price is, $23. But if you're interested in this type of thing, I highly recommend this book. And I'm going to just read a couple that I earmarked here. So I'll read you the Tao, and then I'll read you the Emerson's thoughts so you can compare the two. And in this one particular one verse, it says, this is the Tao here. When the Tao prevails in the world, they send back their swift horses to draw the dung carts. When the Tao is disregarded in the world, the war horses breed in the borderlands. There is no guilt greater than to sanction ambition, no calamity greater than to be discontented with one's lot, no fault greater than the wish to be getting, and therefore the sufficiency of contentment is an enduring and unchanging sufficiency. And that's a translation of the Tao. And Emerson's similar thought is, a man's wisdom is to know what all ends are momentary. Let me repeat that. A man's wisdom is to know that all ends are momentary. If he listens with insatiable ears, richer and greater wisdom is taught him. He is the fool of ideas and leads a heavenly life. His health and greatness consists in his being the channel through which heaven flows to earth. That man, seeing this, can lose it from his thoughts. Or what man, seeing this, can lose it from his thoughts? And again, there's one other. Without going outside his door, one understands all that takes place under the sky. Without looking out from his window, one sees the Tao of heaven. The farther that one goes out from himself, the less he knows. Therefore, the sages got their knowledge without traveling, gave their right name to things without seeing them, and accomplished their ends without any purpose of doing so. And Emerson stated, the soul is no traveler. A wise man stays at home. He does not go abroad with the hope of finding somewhat greater than he knows. The soul that is plain and true dwells in the hour that now is, in the earnest experience of the common day, and the mere trifle becomes porous to thought and bibulous to the sea of light. And that coming from him, and he was he had traveled to Europe and on a number of occasions, but for him to say that the soul is no traveler, the wise man stays at home, he realized after his travels that he really didn't need them to enlighten him. And another one that I'll leave you with is, let's see if I can, better one here. Oh, we'll do this, this is short. He who devotes himself to learning seeks from day to day to increase his knowledge. He who devotes himself to the Tao seeks from day to day to diminish his doing. He diminishes it and again diminishes it, till he arrives at doing nothing on purpose. Having arrived at this point of non-action, there is nothing which he does not do. And that was the Tao. And Emerson states, let us unlearn our wisdom of the world. Let us take our bloated nothingness out of the path of divine circuits. Let us lie low and learn that truth alone makes rich and great. The rich mind lies in the sun and sleeps and is nature. To think is to act. And in the 29 seconds I have left of this of streaming here, I apologize for the mess up of this tape, but I hope you enjoyed what you did here. And next week we'll please join us tomorrow night with George Dixon, and we discuss the Mayan calendar and the sixth day that we're in now, and the current events that are taking place as prophesized by the Mayans. And I wish you good night.